www.thebridge.org. Today is Sunday, December 21st, 2025, and this is episode 24 of The Rift. If you live in the United States, you probably have a refrigerator. In fact, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, it's a near certainty. 99.9% of U.S. households have one, making it the most ubiquitous home appliance in the country. Today, industrialized nations of the global north are completely reliant on refrigeration. Household refrigerators are so commonplace, in fact, that you may not realize that their footprint extends far beyond your kitchen. Getting refrigerated and frozen food from the farm or factory to your fridge requires an enormous infrastructure of refrigerated warehouses, trucks, trains, and shipping containers, collectively known as the cold chain. And the cold chain has changed nearly everything about the way we grow food, the way we eat, the way we work, and the way we live. It's also changing the biosphere itself, with its growing energy use and greenhouse gas emissions. But what's the origins of food preservation through refrigeration? And what might the future hold for it, especially in a warming world? To find out, I spoke with author, journalist, and podcast host Nicola Twilley, who spent the last decade researching and writing the book Frostbite: How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about the past and present of refrigeration, how it's changed our food, our environment, and our politics, and what the future might hold for the cold chain and food preservation. But first, programming on WEFT is made possible in part by Common Ground Food Co-op. Located in Lincoln Square Mall, Common Ground is Champaign-Urbana's only community-owned grocery store, specializing in local and organic foods. All are welcome, and no membership is required to shop at the Common Ground Food Co-op. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you in part by Plant Mode in downtown Champaign. Since 2013, Plant Mode has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical and succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records, and local-made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, and rolling pins. Plant Mode, now at the 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram and on plantmode.com. And now, here's my interview with Nicola Twilley. Joined now by the author of the book Frostbite: How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves, Nicola Twilley. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I was reading this book, and I really enjoyed reading it. And you know, I'm someone who probably thinks about the ecology of supply chains more than your average individual, and even then, I learned so much. And I feel refrigeration is so ubiquitous today that I think a lot of us don't even think about it, especially, you know, in the West, where everyone has a refrigerator in their house. People, it's just there, and you don't think about the extent to which it shapes our food system and our lives. And in fact, that's a theme that you come back to repeatedly in the book, that one of the things refrigeration has done is to help invisibilize the process of food production and transportation. So with that in mind, I'm curious how you were drawn to this topic and what motivated you to write the book.
Yeah, so the first thing to say is that it took me a very long time to research and write this book. So you're going to have to cast your mind back to the 2010s when the expression farm to table was taking over the food world. And you know, Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser had just come out with their books looking at sort of the behind the scenes of the industrial food world. You know, Omnivore's Dilemma, Fast Food Nation, kind of giving us our first peek at, you know, big ag and feedlots and such like. And I was gripped by those books, and I wished I had written them myself. I was jealous of them. But then this expression farm to table was everywhere. And I thought, you know, they've shown us the farm, but what about the two? What about that piece? I don't know what is that piece? What does it look like? And then that's when I sort of realized, you know, I've never seen inside a refrigerated warehouse. And at this point, you know, I had been writing about food for a little while and I had seen all sorts of things. And you go inside factories, you visit farms. But I was like, there's this other piece and I haven't seen it and I haven't read about it. Let's go check that out. And it was the start of falling down a rabbit hole for, like I say, more than a decade. So,
yeah. And, you know, as you mentioned, so much of the book is kind of about that, the process of transit, right? The way that it changes geographies. And throughout the book, you illustrate how some of these technologies, especially the ones that allow us to move food products all over the country and all over the world, have transformed practically everything about the way that we live and eat and work, from the emergence of refrigerated trucking and rail contributing to the boom of the meat industry, to the household refrigerator transforming domestic life and urban design and even women's participation in the workforce. So could you talk a little bit about those transformations as you kind of encountered them and maybe what the biggest thing you took away from exploring them was?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is where I realized it was a book, because initially I was just like, oh, I'm curious. I'll go take a look inside some of these spaces. And I actually initially started out just documenting refrigerated warehouses, where they were, what they look like, how many of them were there, that sort of thing, with an organization called the Center for Land Use Interpretation. And it was when I realized, like you say, that actually these are not just places, they have actually transformed what we eat, where it's grown, you know, what it tastes like, how good it is for us, how good it is for the planet, that they've had this huge impact, that I realized I wanted to tell those stories too. And that's how the book really came about. And I think it just sort of, there's so many ways in which refrigeration has ended up reshaping our entire relationship with food. I mean, you mentioned meat. One of the things that is, it just, if you trace that through, you can go everything from the level of sort of how much meat people ate, which has a measurable impact on Americans' height. You can see there's an economist in North Carolina who is, you know, dug into the data using West Point military recruits, and you can actually trace the impact of refrigeration and the meat supply going, you know, meat availability going way up because the price has fallen. You can see that reflected in the height of the incoming West Point cadets. So measurable differences in height, measurable differences in the length of a hog's gut because of how quickly these animals had to be fed to be able to be slaughtered en masse. Because one of the things is, once you have refrigeration, you have to scale up production. You can't just, you know, slaughter a couple animals because you need them now and slaughter a couple animals because you need them later. You have a production line now and refrigerated warehouses to fill and a refrigerated rail car to fill, and you have to work at that kind of scale. So it physically changes the animals, it physically changes humans. So on that sort of pure biological level, to then geopolitical levels that just astonished me. And I think one of the most astonishing connections that was drawn, not by me, by an Irish economist actually, was between refrigerated meat and Irish independence. And so, you know, I feel like that needs a little unpacking, but what happened, you know, obviously there's a long history of British colonial exploitation in Ireland and, you know, the famines, etc. But really, refrigerated meat, once it started arriving from the Southern Hemisphere, primarily in the UK, you know, cheap, frozen lamb from New Zealand and Australia, frozen beef from South America, it really undercut the prices that the Irish tenant farmers were able to charge for their live meat that they had previously been shipping by ferry over to the UK and then bringing live to be slaughtered in London and sold to Londoners. And suddenly those prices, the cheap frozen meat were just making their business completely untenable. And so they were losing out on revenue. That added to the hurt they were feeling, but it also meant that for their English landlords, this country was no longer profitable. It was not a source of revenue anymore. And so they were actually willing to get out, sell up, and there was government compensation available for sort of giving up their land in England. And so that dynamic of the English being ready to let it go because they weren't making any money anymore, and the Irish being even more without revenue, sort of, you know, this refrigerated and frozen meat comes in the, you know, 1880s and 1870s, 1880s, and by 1916 you have Irish independence. And obviously, you know, there are a lot of other factors, but it's a big one and a really interesting one. And simultaneously on the other side of the world, you know, New Zealand had been failing as a colony because it wasn't economically viable. You couldn't make enough money just on selling the sheep's wool, you know, and you couldn't do anything with the meat without refrigeration. And refrigeration and being able to ship that meat to European markets is what made New Zealand viable as a colony. And so you get one instance where the British pull out and another instance where the British colonize. And so you see refrigeration having these geopolitical effects that I think we don't attribute to it.
Right, yeah. I mean, reading about, and this is something that you touched on, that refrigeration helped kind of balance the way that there were all these meat producers kind of out in the countryside. And meanwhile, you have these an industrializing population, people flocking to cities, and you need a way to get the product to the cities to feed people. And that was part of what enabled the meat industry to happen, such as it is. You know, I used to work on indigenous land rights and forest protection in Brazil and in the Amazon. And of course, the biggest thing that you hear out of Brazil is the agribusiness and meat industries, the beef industry in particular, more or less just clear-cutting enormous swaths of the Amazon. And it just kind of made me think, would we have gotten here without refrigeration? Probably not.
Absolutely not. And it, you know, there are astonishing stories of, you know, Argentinian, you know, ranchers whose, you know, herd is so worthless, you know, because all you could do was sell the hides because you couldn't monetize the meat because there was no way to preserve it. There was a brief fad for jerky, never caught on as a sort of industrial sort of substitute, but they would literally drive their herds off cliffs rather because it was cheaper in some markets, you know, the price they were getting for hides was cheaper to just get rid of the herd than actually bother going through the expense of slaughtering it. So it wasn't ever going to be the kind of thing you would, you know, bother clear cutting the Amazon for until you could ship meat at scale to the meat hungry cities of the north. And that the other piece of it that you refer to, that urbanization, is also really interesting because in the 1800s was really the first time that cities started to get above a million and run into this crisis of how do we supply ourselves with fresh food? You know, and walking meat to market and slaughtering it in the middle of a city, I mean, there's these amazing stories of pigs in Central Park and more pigs in Kensington, which is a very posh part of London, than humans, and dairy cattle being, you know, kept in basements under the Strand, which is the theatre district now in London. And so just this sort of makeshift attempts to get perishable foods to people in cities. They didn't really care about vegetables so much at that point. There hadn't been the research establishing that vitamins are what they are and that we need them. But there had been research establishing what protein was. And actually, scientists at the time had mistakenly concluded that protein was the only essential nutrient. And carbohydrate and fat were just nice to have, not necessary to have. And so there was this protein panic and a lot of, you know, realization that these kind of makeshift, you know, bringing cattle into the city to slaughter them, storing pigs under people's beds in Kensington, it just wasn't going to work. And so the refrigeration boom sort of comes out of this panic and allows meat consumption in cities to really skyrocket.
Right. And I'm glad you touched on the protein panic, because that I thought that was one of the really interesting things that you wrote about, is the extent to which the early development of the technology and industry of refrigeration was driven by these socially mediated understandings of nutrition, right? This protein craze that led to a boom in the meat industry. And then, as you kind of hinted at, people started to understand a little bit more about the vitamins inside of vegetables and fruits. And then all of a sudden, you have a much greater interest in preserving salad vegetables. And I'm curious if you've seen, there's all these different trends kind of happening in food today, right? You almost see the protein thing coming back. Everything's marketed with protein kind of plastered all over it. Do you see that same interplay kind of maintaining between our social understanding of what kind of diet is desirable or healthy and how we preserve food?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And you see it from the dawn of refrigeration. It's sort of what we think we need is driving the technology. But today, it's much more in sort of how we shop. So there is, even in the US, which is the most refrigerated country in the world, we have more refrigerated space kind of per capita than anywhere else. The cold storage industry is still growing. It's sort of seen as a hot market in real estate. And that's an interesting one, because the reason it's growing is because its location is shifting, because how we shop is shifting. And so refrigerated warehouses are becoming much smaller in cities to cope with on demand. How we all have to have our groceries within 2 hours of ordering them delivered to our door. Well, you can't do that from a big out of town refrigerated warehouse that is, you know, previously refrigerated warehouses would have been situated either right next to the factory producing the yogurt, the ice cream, whatever, or at ports to import and export, or at major kind of logistical hubs. So you get big freeway intersections that will have enormous quantities of refrigerated warehouses around them, because the trucks can come there and then they can drop off. Now, we have this much more just-in-time, on-demand kind of expectation around our groceries, and the refrigerated warehouse landscape is having to shift around that. You see, even with the expansion of the Panama Canal and that's driven a huge boom in refrigerated warehouses along the East Coast, because now companies are going to be able to import and export along those ports rather than having to go to West Coast ports, which are all unionized and much more difficult for companies, perceived as much more difficult for companies to work with. So you do see these kinds of like odd shifts in both our own activities as consumers and then these larger kind of geopolitical threads still play out in the landscape of refrigeration today. And also, I think there's just something really interesting about how important refrigerated foods are to the market. I mean, I went to the Frankfurt Perishable Center, which is the largest airport-based refrigerated warehouse. So for import of things that come by air rather than boat. And they said German supermarkets have, you know, there's certain things that if a customer comes into a shop and those things are not there, that customer will turn around and go somewhere else. Top of that list was strawberries, which means you can't be without strawberries on, you know, January 4th. Like, it's not strawberry season, it's, you know, but no, that's an essential. And so their role is, you know, filling the strawberry gap around shipments. But it's just it's an interesting thing that these refrigerated supply chains have sort of inserted themselves so prominently in our expectations that that's sort of what the entire system is designed to maintain now.
Yeah, it made me think about how, you know, my parents are from India, and when I would go to India as a kid, there were no supermarkets. And that may have been a function of the town that we lived in, maybe there were in bigger cities, but there were no supermarkets where we were at. And so, yeah, you go to the local grocer, you get what's in season and what's locally available. You know, we weren't getting broccoli, we weren't getting apples, we weren't getting different kinds of things like that. And now there are supermarkets and everything's super different for the type of person who can go and shop at the supermarket, which is certainly like a limited subsection of the population. Things are still more expensive there than the guys selling vegetables on the street. But it really, yeah, I've seen that change over the years. And I think reading your book, I was thinking more about how attributable that is to the technology of refrigeration.
It's really incredible. And then what you have alongside that is this sort of diminishment of the range of produce we eat. So because you can have blueberries all year round, then you do have blueberries or bananas or whatever all year round. And our fruit choices have narrowed down to these sort of few globally shippable ones and regional specialties, seasonal specialties that might only be available for a couple weeks and don't refrigerate well and don't ship well. They fall off the menu because they're not part of that supermarket supply chain that has a set of, you know, very, you know, for a fruit to make it in today's refrigerated supply chain, it has to be a pretty tough customer and have had a set of protocols designed for it. You know, there's all kinds of knowledge about how do you ship a blueberry in a shipping container so it stays fresh. We've done that science. And so that's why you get blueberries and not any of the other berries. You know, it's a really interesting kind of like a biodiversity bottleneck almost, where yes, we have this wonderful abundance in our supermarkets and you can have a strawberry on January 4th. But we also have a much narrower range of choices in other ways. And you can't have those micro seasons of a, you know, I don't know, a pawpaw, which is in the U.S., you know, this delicious tropical fruit tasting delight that is very local, regional, seasonal, doesn't refrigerate, and you can't buy it for that reason.
Yeah, I'm going to get more into fruit later because there's a lot of interesting stuff to touch on there. But I do want to make sure before we kind of move too far ahead chronologically that I come back to one of the things that I was really, really interested in, which was the period before mechanized refrigeration that you write about at the start of the book. And there was still quite a lot of food preservation going on using ice. And so in the early parts of the book, you trace this really fascinating economy of frozen water that emerged around the early 19th century or so, and it became so expansive that it involved literally putting ice on ships and sending them across the ocean. And just intuitively, I found that so fascinating because I wouldn't think there was enough ice to go around. And they really only started being able to mechanically produce ice, kind of getting closer to 1900 or so. I think it was late 1800s. So what were the dynamics of ice production? I know that you write about how it was almost viewed as this abundant natural resource in the U.S. because of all of our freshwater lakes.
Yeah, the comparison that I love is that the U.S. was sort of the Middle East of the time, in the way that the Middle East has so much fossil fuel abundance now that is sort of powering the rest of the world. Well, the U.S. at the time had so much natural coal and fresh water that we were the Saudi Arabia of ice at the time and exporting it around the world. And it was this incredible reserve. But yeah, what I love about this story is like, well, first of all, you have to realize like we haven't been able to make ice for very long. Humans have been able to make fire to add heat to things since before we became modern humans. Humans have not known how to take heat away, how to make cold, essentially, for more than 250 years. And when it was discovered, it was sort of seen as this party trick. No one knew what to do with it. And that's, it's, you know, when I started looking back at the history of this, I was like, well, did people not realize that cold preserved food? Were they like stupid? Of course not. People realize that cold preserved food. It's just that when you can't make it and you can't control it, you can't rely on it at scale. And so historically, you know, the Babylonians had ice pits. They were bringing snow down from mountains. They're using it for luxuries. You don't use it for your staples or your essentials the way we think of today, where you're getting your meat and your milk and your basic kind of foods are brought to you by refrigeration. In an era where you can't guarantee cold and you can't make it and you can't even guarantee that you can store it, you can't use it for that. So you use it for delight. And you know, you have these, the Medici were famous for their sort of ice cream parties and chilled wine and things like that. So ice was being used, but not for sort of the mass feeding of cities. And it wasn't until this high school dropout called Frederick Tudor, who is a very sympathetic character, and I visited, you know, his archives are at Yale, and they're fantastic. There's also a fantastic book called The Frozen Water Trade that, if anyone wants to dig deeper, that was a great source for me. But he, you know, he grew up in New England. He had an ice house. They used it for, you know, chilled drinks in summer. And he was like, well, who wouldn't love this in hot parts of the world? He was actually sent with his brother to Cuba. His brother had tuberculosis, and the idea was this would sort of help him recover. And young Frederick was like, oh, it's so hot. If only I had a chilled drink. And then this is when his genius idea occurred to him. And he's like, wow, these Cubans would probably pay a fortune to have ice. And so he basically single-handedly invented this global frozen water trade. And it's an amazing story that involves him going bankrupt 3 times, into prison twice, and nearly giving up, and just kind of failing to think through every aspect of it at the start, which was amazing. You know, he brings ice to Cuba, and oh, guess what? The Cubans have nowhere to store the ice, so it just melts right away. And like, they don't know what it is. They don't want it. It's melting. Like, it's like, you want me to pay for something that's turning into water right now? I mean, it just, every aspect, no one, you know, customs authorities didn't know how to tax it. Ship captains didn't want to carry it because it would melt and throw their sort of ship off balance. He was like, oh, he realized he couldn't even ship it at the time it was harvested because the harbor was iced over if it was cold enough to make ice. So this is before they had, you know, dug deep water harbors. So it was a whole process of literally making every single mistake that was possible. But he develops an industry that is able to ship natural ice as far afield as Sydney, Cape Town, Mumbai, I mean, at a price. Not all of the ice makes it at that point, but still a global trade in ice. And of course, people copy him, and then every single body of water across North America is being harvested and used or exported. And what that did was something amazing, which was show people, oh, if you have enough cold, it's really useful for food. Now it's not just something nice for a chilled drink in summer. Now it's something we can use to preserve our food supply. And so it was really, his industry of using natural ice that made it suddenly seem worthwhile for engineers to go back to that forgotten piece of science from a century earlier and say, oh, maybe we could make cold mechanically and revisit that concept. He had to show there was a point to doing it before the scientists like turned their insight into, you know, a machine that could make cold.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it kind of reminds me, this idea of the U.S. as the Saudi Arabia of ice brings me back a little bit more towards the modern age and one of the more significant innovations in refrigeration being the development of controlled atmospheres, especially for maintaining the freshness of fruits and vegetables. And you write extensively about the gaseous compound ethylene, and its very significant role in that when applied to fruits, it can make them ripen. And so it's used all across the refrigeration industry, across the cold chain, to kind of control at what stage these fruits kind of are in their ripening process as they're being transported. And it's also a significant tie between the cold chain and the fossil fuel economy. Industrial ethylene production uses natural gas or crude oil byproducts as a feedstock, and there are these big, big industrial plants that take all that in and use a ton of energy and spit ethylene out. And so, of course, as we try to transition away from fossil fuels, this appears to be an area where the industry is really kind of tied into the fossil economy that permeates so many more areas of our lives than I think a lot of people would expect. So as we try and, you know, make that transition happen, what impact do you think that it could have on ethylene's use in the refrigeration industry?
That's a really interesting question. Yeah, ethylene is a funny compound. And of course, it's the reason it works to do what it does, you know, to tell a banana to ripen, to tell a tomato to ripen, is that it is actually a plant hormone as well. So it's not just that it's a, you know, a product of fossil fuels, plants are making it. The reason, in fact, that it was initially discovered is that apples give it off as they sort of turn mushy and start to, you know, start to sort of melt and decay. And what that would do is, one, it's sort of the root of the expression of like one bad apple in the barrel, because one bad apple, one elderly apple in the barrel will be emitting enough ethylene to make the rest of the barrel also turn old and mushy and decay. So you with apples, you want to keep ethylene away. With bananas and tomatoes, because you want to ship them while they're still hard and unripe, you actually deliberately then have to gas them with ethylene when they're ready to sell, otherwise they won't ripen. So it's a sort of a thing that kind of works both ways, and some fruits and vegetables need to have what are called ethylene scrubbers to keep the ethylene away, so apples being one of those. And I would say it's a really, you know, it's a really interesting question, because my understanding, and I have only looked at this sort of tangentially, is that most ethylene that is produced industrially today in these very polluting plants that are incredibly energy intensive, as you say, most of that is used for polyethylene. So it's going towards plastics, which we are also extremely addicted to, and that are also a part of our refrigerated supply chain, of course, because once you're moving things big different distances, you're needing to protect them somehow. You know, that layer of wax paper is no longer going to do it when you're shipping it around the globe. So plastic is definitely tied into our refrigerated economy. The ethylene usage that is actually used to ripen fruits and vegetables, I don't know how big of a piece of our ethylene usage overall that is. Yes, it's coming from fossil fuels. And, you know, a banana ripening room will be buying canisters of ethylene to ripen its bananas. But I think it's probably not at the scale of say, for example, plastics, which are a much bigger tie. What would happen if we stopped making ethylene and the banana ripeners had to go back to doing it the old school way? Well, when banana ripeners first figured out that they needed to do this, you know, they had managed to ship the bananas under refrigeration and now they wanted to sell them to people. They needed to turn them yellow and edible. They would use kerosene lamps, which give off ethylene as they're burning. It's just sort of a byproduct of inefficient burning. And that, you know, they could go back to that. They could stick some elderly apples in the room. I don't know. But it would be an interesting hurdle for them to overcome. I think the biggest way for us to cut down on our ethylene production would be to cut down our plastic usage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, kind of going along with that, obviously it's the dominant narrative across, I think, most of Western society that technology is progress, and certainly a technology like refrigeration that's almost seen as a measure of development or industrialization. And some of what you write about complicates that narrative. Obviously, it's true in many respects, but you do have things like the fundamental changes that we've made to these carefully engineered refrigeration-friendly produce varietals that are actually lower in nutritional value than they used to be. The explosion of industrial meat production, you know, as I've mentioned, that kind of speaks for itself. And of course, the ever-increasing energy footprint, the use of refrigerants. Could you elaborate on what you've learned about the drawbacks of refrigeration in the cold chain?
Yeah, this is a funny thing because if refrigeration is seen as such a blessing by so many, and believe me, when I open a cold beer at the end of a long day, I am one of those people. but you know, sort of in the, you know, United Nations Development Goals and World Bank sort of support and Gates Foundation kind of objectives and things like that, there's this wholesale embrace of refrigeration as a way that, you know, countries such as, say, Rwanda, where I spent a lot of time reporting this book, or its neighbor where I just was, Kenya, this is a way that they can achieve their sustainable development goals, and they can lift people out of poverty and improve nutrition and all of the things that they need to do. And so it is seen as this universal good. And I definitely, and it felt like this is a really important moment to do this because much of the world does not yet have a cold chain, but is about to build one. And it felt like, well, let's just have a tiny moment where we evaluate, has it been a universal blessing before we go ahead and implement exactly the same thing we've built here? And so, yes, I would say refrigeration has a huge number of benefits. It also has some serious downsides. And the most serious, the one that is really kind of a bit of a nightmare if you want to continue living on the planet, is that it has a huge emissions footprint. And that is not just from its energy use, although it is from its energy use. And people say, oh, well, why wouldn't you just switch to renewables? Well, we can't build renewables fast enough for our existing energy usage. And so now we're going to build it for an entire new cold chain all around the rest of the world that doesn't have one yet. Maybe, but you know, that's a lot of renewables. And second of all, it's not just that. It's in fact the refrigerant chemicals themselves. Some, not all, but most of the ones that are currently in use, and especially the ones that are being adopted in the developing world because they are the most straightforward to use without a lot of technical expertise, are what are called super greenhouse gases, meaning they emit many, they are many thousands of times more polluting than a ton of CO2. And so that's a disaster. And the cumulative effect of that is that currently, right now, and this is right now before Rwanda builds a cold chain, the global emissions from refrigeration just for food, not for cooling buildings or cooling data centers or cooling medical supplies or any of the other things we use it for, but just refrigeration for food, is already greater than the global emissions for aviation. Already. When I wrote the book, they were roughly parallel. It has since increased. So that's astonishing. You hear all the time that one of the biggest things you can do is not fly. We have to fix aviation. Aviation is a huge problem. Does anyone talk about fixing refrigeration? Very, 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 very few people. And so that's something I really wanted to draw attention to, is we can't continue to refrigerate the same way. Fortunately, we don't have to, but we really can't. And at the moment, that is what is happening. That is what's going ahead. And then the other thing is, why do we have to make the same mistakes? I mean, one of the things that is sort of a famous sort of example in development literature is, you know, sub-Saharan African countries didn't have to build out a landline telephone system because they went straight to cell phones. And they don't have to have, you know, banks and checkbooks because they're going straight to digital banking and adopting it much more rapidly even than us in North America. And so there was this idea that, you know, maybe we could skip some of the, if we're aware, for example, that refrigeration has this tendency towards scale, because it's like we were talking about with the meat example. You can't just have a couple chickens here and a couple chickens there to make the investment in a refrigerated warehouse worthwhile. You have to have plenty of chickens. Well, you can, if you know that is an issue, can you be thoughtful about how you implement it? Where should that scale occur? Can you have independent smallholders with access to a larger refrigerated warehouse, but not having to purchase that on their own? You know, some sort of cooperative scheme, for example. Just if you know that a big supermarket will decimate small shopping areas and shopkeepers, and you want to keep those because you want a walkable city, you don't want food deserts, you don't want people to have to drive to a grocery store, well, that's great. You have tools to make it so that a large supermarket on the edge of town can't be built and drive all the traffic out of town. So it's not like these are impossible challenges. Right. It's more that if we don't think about them, we are going to make the same mistakes again. And it would just be great not to make all the same mistakes again.
Yeah, I think one of the, you put it very succinctly in the book, and I'm quoting here, cold chains present a double bind. Both their absence and their presence have huge ecological costs. And yeah, the same can be said for their impacts on economics and geopolitics and these less industrialized countries that don't have cold chains, there's more food waste, there's more malnutrition, there's more hunger. And obviously those are problems that have a lot of different vectors, but refrigeration can certainly help out with them. But of course, the energy use and the ecological impacts of refrigerants and all of these other negative impacts of refrigeration industry at scale that you've just talked about can do immense damage. They are doing immense damage to the biosphere, and can certainly do damage to local producers and to our desire for walkable cities and for all these other things. With all that in mind, and I guess I'm trying to put a bit of a bow on things here, what do you think the future holds for refrigeration? I guess that's a kind of a huge question, but maybe the last decade of being in that world can give you a good answer for it.
Yeah, I mean, what I think will happen depends on whether you catch me on a day where I'm feeling optimistic or whether I'm not. But I will say people are increasingly talking about this. I think, for example, I keynoted a conference about clean cold in Birmingham last month. And so that was full of development folks and refrigeration folks. So industry and sort of that world of, you know, NGOs and agencies who are thinking about the future of refrigeration. And a lot of them found my talk very surprising, but a lot of them found it very thought-provoking and interesting, and wanted to talk with me more about it and wanted to incorporate it into the way they're thinking about how to do this. And so that was very encouraging to me. Other things that are very encouraging to me are the fact that actually, you know, as is always the case, research continues and people are finding other alternatives. And so, you know, there's a company that's spun out of scientific research at Cambridge University in the UK that has developed an alternate method of refrigeration that doesn't come with any of those emissions from the refrigerants and is twice as efficient energy-wise as current vapor compression systems. And so that's amazing. It works just by sort of compressing and releasing a particular form of a very cheap, readily available plastic. And in so doing, you know, disturb the order of all of the molecules by squishing it. And then as they rearrange themselves, when you release it, they have to pull in energy from the atmosphere to do their rearrangement. Well, pulling in energy from the atmosphere, they're pulling it in the form of heat, which then cools the atmosphere. So this is an incredible, it's called barocaloric cooling. They have a prototype that works. If all the world's new refrigerated warehouses were running on this technology, you know, we'd be talking about a very different future. The thing that I really love, though, is that people are addressing different ways to preserve food. And so there's, for example, an Indian potato farmer was incredibly frustrated at the waste he was seeing, at the lack of cold chain, went to Cornell University, has developed an entirely new way of preserving what would be frozen French fries at ambient. So the system is you put them in this specially designed bag and you sit them in a room and you use supercritical carbon dioxide. So that's carbon dioxide that's operating as both a gas and a liquid. And that, I want to say it almost sort of cooks them in a way, but not. But it treats them in such a way that you can now store them at ambient and they're actually a little tastier than normal French fries because of this. They're a little crispier when you cook them. And it's amazing because imagine, you know, now every, you know, fast food restaurant in America could, you know, radically cut its walk-in size that it needs. That's amazing. For farmers, you know, growing potatoes, it's a huge deal because if you could take your potatoes to a factory that was doing this, then you wouldn't need cold storage and to pay for cold storage and you wouldn't have the loss. So I love, and the reason I give these examples is I think, you know, we know we're using cold to preserve food mostly. Yes, beer should be cold for flavor reasons. Ice cream needs to be cold for flavor reasons. But mostly food needs to be fresh, not cold. And if we remember that's the goal, then we can also remember that maybe there are other ways to achieve it. You know, just because we have a hammer, not everything is a nail. And refrigeration is a hammer. It preserves food. It doesn't have to be the only way we do it. And so I think that is also a really important thing to remember. Once you have a technology, sometimes the temptation is to use it everywhere and have it do everything. But if we remember that refrigeration comes with costs and downsides, and that really what we're trying to do is preserve food, we can be more open-minded about, okay, so what's the best way to do that actually? And design a better food system as a result. So yeah.
Holistic planning, thinking about what can be of greatest benefit to society. How hard could it be?
I know, it's, you know, and then you're like, yeah, no.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I thought the book was really fantastic. So just before you go, how can people follow your continued work?
Oh, well, A, thank you for saying that. It means a lot. It was a lot of work to write this book. And so I love knowing that it's found an audience and people who think about it in such a deep way. So thank you. And secondly, I co-host a podcast about food science and history called Gastropod. So if people enjoy the book, they might enjoy listening to that new episode every week, available wherever you get your podcasts. And I also write. So I am a writer for The New Yorker. And so occasionally you can find my long form stories. I have a new one coming out in January there too.
Great. Well, the book is Frostbite: How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves, published by Penguin Books. And the author is who I've just spent the last so-and-so minutes talking to, Nicola Twilley. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me and for the great questions. I appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Nicola Twilley, author of Frostbite: How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves. I really did enjoy this book. I think it's great. And as someone who spent most of my adult life working on environmental issues, I'm a strong advocate of knowing where stuff comes from, whether it's energy or food or water. So much of that production process and logistics and transportation is made invisible, particularly for those of us here in the global north. And I think that Nicola has written a really captivating and accessible book that does that for refrigeration. So definitely give it a look if you feel so inclined. As Nicola mentioned, she also co-hosts a podcast on the history of science and culture of food called Gastropod, which can be found on the various podcast services, which is also where you'll be able to find the recording of this episode of The Rift, which will be online later this evening. You can also access it from linktree.com/TheRiftRadio. That's it for today's show, and that's it for The Rift in 2025. As always, thank you so much for listening to WEFT 90.1 FM Community Radio from Champaign, Illinois. I'll be back in January with more episodes of The Rift, but for now, as usual, we have some tunes up until the top of the hour and then On the Move with Herbert Burnett. I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season and are able to share it with people you care about. I'll see you in 2026. Take care.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. For companies around the world, the financial risks of climate change are growing fast. As seas rise, coastal factories face a growing risk of flooding. As droughts intensify, crops could become more expensive to grow. And as storms and fires get more extreme, insurance premiums are rising.
We should be talking about climate change impacts as being business impacts.
That's Sherry Madeira of CDP, a nonprofit that helps companies worldwide measure and disclose data about their environmental impacts and risks. According to a CDP report, the roughly 4,000 large companies who disclose data to the group identified climate risks totaling more than $6 trillion.
And of course, that is shocking in terms of its size.
But she says companies can invest in solutions that reduce these risks. For example, flood-proofing buildings, relocating facilities, or planning for supply chain disruptions could make businesses less vulnerable to climate change impacts. According to the CDP report, taking these and other steps would cost about $1.4 trillion. So acting to reduce climate risks may be costly in the short term, but the long-term cost of inaction could be far greater. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Bethel Bethany United Church of Christ in Milwaukee recently lowered its electric bills and reduced its climate warming pollution by switching to energy-efficient LED lights. Nearby, the Sherman Park Grocery Store installed a 50-gallon rain barrel to capture stormwater running off the roof.
We have seen how people are really interested in reducing flooding, in reducing stormwater on their property.
That's Ifeoluwapo Toloranju of the Sherman Park Community Association, which supported these projects through its Greening Congregations initiative. The program helps faith groups, small businesses, and apartment buildings in the area implement climate solutions. Some cut carbon pollution, while others reduce stormwater runoff, which is a growing problem as climate change causes more heavy downpours. The group also hires high school students to help, which exposes them to possible environmental careers. And many of the projects are at central locations in the community. For example, churches often host food pantries, schools, and daycares.
Meaning that people go there at least maybe 2 times in a week.
So through these projects, the whole community can see climate solutions in action. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate disasters like hurricanes and heat waves can send people to the hospital, with problems ranging from injuries to heat stroke. This can lead to unexpected medical bills for families and rising costs for employers who help pay for their employees' health insurance.
Every CFO in America knows how much they're spending on healthcare benefits for their workers and family members.
Tracy Watts is with the HR consulting firm Mercer, which worked with the National Commission on Climate and Workforce Health to create the Climate Health Cost Forecaster. The online tool shows companies how extreme heat, poor air quality, floods, and hurricanes could increase the cost of their employees' health care over the next decade. Better understanding these costs could motivate companies to take action to protect their employees as climate change causes more extreme weather. For example, companies can provide cooling and hydration stations and create safety plans for extreme weather events.
If you have some targeted adaptation strategies, it will greatly benefit not only your business, but your people as well, which are probably your greatest asset.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
WEFT, you're here with me, celebrating a little music. We love to do these things, we love to have that fun. We love to do these things on WEFT. Who knows, this could be the new jingle for WEFT.
Repeat that.
Who knows, this could be new jingle for WEFT.
Straight freestyle.
WEFT.
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 WEFT. WEFT.
WEFT.
WEFT. WEFT. WEFT. WEFT.
WEFT.
WEFT. WEFT.
WEFT.
Simply amazing.
We appreciate you.
Thank you, DM.
Like, we prepared for it, yeah.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, by calling 217-355-0500, or in person at their new location in the Shops of Knollwood Shopping Center at 2131 South Neal Street.
But if you don't come in the room, I'm going to be like the video, take me through there. I'm going to ask, where we going?
Where we going?
And we're going to go nowhere fast. Lord, come on in the room.